barking at them and pretending to be dangerous. This was Donald, the dog who had been such a comfort to Roy during the last months of his life. Even dogs had names back then. Donald was the dog, Robert was the man, and Donald was harmless. He had never bitten anybody. All he wanted was for someone to throw a stick for him, so he could bring it back, so somebody could throw a stick for him, so he could bring it back, and so on. Donald wasn't very smart, to say the least. He certainly wasn't going to write Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. When Donald slept, he would often whimper, and his hind legs would shiver. He was dreaming of chasing sticks. Robert was frightened of dogs, because he and his mother had been attacked by a Doberman Pinscher when Robert was only 5 years old. Robert was all right with dogs, as long as there was someone around who knew how to control them. But whenever he was alone with one, no matter what size it was, he sweated and he trembled, and his hair stood on end. So he was extremely careful to avoid such situations. But his marriage proposal so surprised Mary Hepburn that she burst into tears, something nobody does anymore. She was so embarrassed and confused that she apologized to him brokenly, and she ran into the house. She didn't want to be married to anybody but Roy. Even if Roy was dead, she still didn't want to be married to anybody but Roy. So, that left Robert all alone on the front lawn with Donald. If Robert's big brain had been any good, it would have had him walk deliberately to his car while telling Donald scornfully to shut up and go home and so on. But it had him turn and run instead. His brain was so defective that it had him run right past his car, with Donald loping right behind him, and he crossed the street and climbed an apple tree in the front yard of an empty house belonging to a family which had moved to Alaska. So Donald sat under the tree and barked up at him. Robert was up there for an hour, afraid to come down, until Mary, wondering why Donald had been barking so monotonously for so long, came out of her house and rescued him. When Robert came down, he was nauseated by fear and self-loathing. He actually threw up. After that, and he had spattered his own shoes and pant cuffs, he said snarlingly, "I am not a man. I am simply not a man. I will, of course, never bother you again. I will never bother any woman ever again." And I retell this story of Mary's at this point because Captain Adolf von Kleist, who would hold the same low opinion of his worth, after churning the ocean to a lather for 5 nights and days, and failing to find an island of any kind. He was too far north, much too far north. So we were all too far north, much too far north. I wasn't hungry, of course, and neither was James Waite, who was frozen solid in the meat locker in the galley below. The galley, although stripped of light bulbs and without portholes, could still be illuminated, albeit hellishly, by the heating elements of its electric ovens and stoves. Yes, and the plumbing was still working, too. There was plenty of water on tap everywhere, both hot and cold. So nobody was thirsty, but everybody was surely ravenous. Kazak, Selina's dog, was missing, and I put no star before her name, for Kazak was dead. The Kankabono girls had stolen her while Selina slept, and choked her with their bare hands, and skinned and gutted her with no other tools than their teeth and fingernails. They had roasted her in an oven. Nobody else knew that they had done that yet. She had been consuming her own substance anyway. By the time they killed her, she was skin and bones. If she had made it to Santa Rosalia, she wouldn't have had much of a future, even in the unlikely event that there had been a male dog there. She had been neutered after all. All she could have accomplished, which might have outlasted her own lifetime, would have been to give the furry Akiko, soon to be born, infantile memories of a dog. Under the best of circumstances, Kazak would not have lived long enough for the other children born on the island to pet her, and to see her wag her tail, and so on. They wouldn't have had her bark to remember, since Kazak never barked. Chapter 6. I say now of Kazak's untimely death, lest anyone should be moved to tears. Oh, well. She wasn't going to write Beethoven's Ninth Symphony anyway. I say the same thing about the death of James Waite. Oh, well. He wasn't going to write Beethoven's Ninth Symphony anyway. This wry comment on how little most of us were likely to accomplish in life, no matter how long we lived, isn't my own invention. I first heard it spoken in Swedish at a funeral while I was still alive. The corpse at that particular rite of passage was an obtuse and unpopular shipyard foreman named Per Olaf Rosenquist. He had died young, or what was thought to be young in those days, because he, like James Waite, had inherited a defective heart. I went to the funeral with a fellow welder named Hjalmar Arvid Bostrom. Not that it can matter much what anybody's name was a million years ago. As we left the church, Bostrom said to me, "Oh, well, he wasn't going to write Beethoven's Ninth Symphony anyway." I asked him if this black joke was original, and he said no, that he had heard it from his German grandfather, who had been an officer in charge of burying the dead in the Western Front during World War I. It was common for soldiers new to that sort of work to wax philosophical over this corpse or that one, into whose face he was about to shovel dirt, speculating about what he might have done if he hadn't died so young. There were many cynical things a veteran might say to such a thoughtful recruit, and one of those was, "Don't worry about it. He wasn't going to write Beethoven's Ninth Symphony anyway." After I myself was buried, young in Malmö, only 6 meters from Per Olaf Rosenquist, Hjalmar Arvid Bostrom said that about me, as he left the cemetery. Oh, well. Leon wasn't going to write Beethoven's Ninth Symphony anyway. Yes, and I was reminded of that comment when Captain von Kleist chided Mary for weeping about the death of the man they believed to be Willard Fleming. They had been out to sea for only 12 hours then, and the captain still felt easily superior to her, and, for that matter, to practically everyone. He said to her, while he told her how to hold the ship on its western course, "What a waste of time to cry about a total stranger. From what you tell me, he had no relatives, and was no longer engaged in any useful work. So what is there to cry about?" That might have been a good time for me to say, as a disembodied voice, he certainly wasn't going to write Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. He made a sort of a joke now, but it didn't really sound like much of a joke. "As captain of this ship," he said, "I order you to cry only when there is something to cry about. There's nothing to cry about now."
"He was my husband," she said. "I choose to take that ceremony you performed very seriously. You can laugh if you want."
Waite was right out back on the subject still. He hadn't been put in the freezer yet.
"He gave a lot to this world, and he had a lot still to give if only we could have saved him."
"What did this man give the world that was so wonderful?" asked the captain.
"He knew more about windmills than anybody alive," she said. "He said we could close down the coal mines and the uranium mines, that windmills alone could make the coldest parts of the world as warm as Miami, Florida. He was also a composer."
"Really?" said the captain.
"Yes," she said. "He wrote 2 symphonies.
I found that piquant. In view of what I've just been saying, that Waite, during his last night on Earth, should have claimed to have written 2 symphonies. Mary went on to say that when she got back home, she was going to go to Moose Jaw and find those symphonies, which had never been performed, and try to get an orchestra to give them a premiere. "Willard was such a modest man," she said. So it would seem, said the captain. 108 hours later, the captain would find himself in direct competition with the reputation of this modest paragon.
If only Willard were still alive, she said, he would know exactly what to do.
The captain had wholly lost his self-respect, and although he had 30 more years to live, he would never get it back again. How is that for a real tragedy? He was abject in the face of Mary's mockery.
I am certainly open to suggestions, he said. You have only to tell me what the wonderful Willard would have done, and that is what I will most gladly do.
He had by then fired his brain, and was navigating on the advice of his soul alone, turning the ship this way and then that way. An island the size of a handkerchief would have inspired the captain to sob in gratitude. And yes, yet again, the sun, now dead ahead, now to port, now astern, now to starboard, was going down. On the deck below, Selina McIntosh was calling for her dog.
Kazak! Kazak! Has anybody seen my dog?
Mary yelled back. She's not up here. And then, trying to imagine what Willard would have done, she came up with the idea that Mandarax, along with being a clock and translator and so on, might also be a radio. She told the captain to try to call for help with it. The captain didn't know the instrument was a Mandarax. He thought it was a Gokubi, and he had a Gokubi in his handkerchief drawer, along with some cufflinks and shirt studs and watches, in his house back in Quito. His brother had given it to him the previous Christmas, but he hadn't found it useful. To him, it was just another toy. And he knew this much about it, that it was certainly not a radio. Now he weighed what he thought was a Gokubi in his hand, and he said to Mary,
I would give my right arm to have this piece of junk be a radio. I promise you, though, not even the saintly Willard Fleming could send or receive a message with a Gokubi.
Maybe it's time you stopped being so absolutely certain about so much, said Mary.
That thought has occurred to me, he said.
Then send an SOS, said Mary.
What harm can it do?
No harm, surely, said the captain. Mrs. Fleming, you are absolutely right. It can surely do no harm.
He spoke into the tiny microphone of Mandarax, saying the international word for a ship in distress 1,000,000 years ago.
Mayday, 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 he intoned.
He then held the screen of Mandarax so that he and Mary might both read any reply which might appear there. As it happened, they had tapped into that part of the instrument's intellect, lacking in Gokubi, which knew so many quotations on every conceivable subject, including the month of May. On the little screen, these utterly mystifying words appeared. In depraved May, dogwood and chestnut, flowering Judas, to be eaten, to be divided, to be drunk among whispers. T.S. Eliot, 1888 to 1965. Chapter 7. The captain and Mary were able to believe for a moment that they had made contact with the outside world, although no response to an SOS could have come that fast and been so literary. So the captain called again, Mayday, mayday, this is the Bahia de Darwin calling, position unknown, do you read me? To which Mandarax replied,
May will be fine next year, as like as not. Oh, aye, but then we shall be 24.
A. E. Houseman, 1859 to 1936. So then it was evident that the word May was triggering quotations from the instrument itself. The captain puzzled over this. He still believed he had a Gokubi, but that it might be slightly more sophisticated than the one he had at home. Little did he know. He caught on that he was getting responses to the word May.
So then he tried June, and Mandarax replied, June is busting out all over. Oscar Hammerstein II, 1895 to 1960.
October, October,
cried the captain, and Mandarax replied. The skies, they were ashen and sober. The leaves, they were crisped and sere. The leaves, they were withering and sere. It was night in the lonesome October of my most immemorial year. Edgar Allan Poe, 1809 to 1849. So that was that for Mandarax, which the captain still believed to be a gokubi. And Mary said that she might as well go back up into the crow's nest to see what she could see. Before she went up there, though, she had one more barb for the captain. She asked him to name the island she might expect to see very soon. This was something he had done all through the third day at sea, naming islands which were just below the horizon and dead ahead, supposedly.
Keep your eyes peeled for San Cristobal, or maybe Genovesa.
Depending on how far south we are, he had said, or later in the day,
Ah, I know where we are now. At any moment we will be seeing Hood Island, the only nesting place in the world for the waved albatross, the largest bird in the archipelago.
And so on. Those albatrosses, incidentally, are still around today and still nesting on Hood. They have wingspreads as great as 2 meters and remain as committed as ever to the future of aviation. They still think it's the coming thing. As the fifth day drew to a close, though, the captain remained silent when Mary asked him to name any island he believed to be nearby. So she asked him again, and he told her this.
Mount Ararat.
When she got up into the crow's nest, though, I was surprised that she did not cry out in wonderment at what I mistook for a very queer weather phenomenon taking place right over the stern of the ship, and then trailing aft, over the wake. It seemed electrical in nature, although very silent. A close relative of ball lightning, maybe, or St. Elmo's fire. That former high school teacher looked right at it, but gave no sign that she found it at all out of the ordinary. And then I understood that only I could see it, and so knew it for what it was. The blue tunnel into the afterlife. It had come after me again. I had seen it 3 times before, at the moment of my decapitation, and then at the cemetery in Malmö, when Swedish clay was thumping wetly on the lid of my coffin, and Hjalmar Arvid Boström, who certainly was never going to write Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, said of me, oh well, he wasn't going to write Beethoven's Ninth Symphony anyway. Its third appearance was when I myself was up in the crow's nest during a storm in the North Atlantic in the sleet and spray, holding my severed head on high as though it were a basketball. The question the blue tunnel implies by appearing is one only I can answer. Have I at last exhausted my curiosity as to what life is all about? If so, I need only step inside what I liken to a vacuum cleaner. If there is indeed suction within the blue tunnel, which is filled with a light much like that cast off by the electric stoves and ovens of the Bayer de Darwin, it does not seem to trouble my late father, the science fiction writer Kilgore Trout, who can stand right in the nozzle and chat with me. The first thing Father said to me from above the stern of the Bayer de Darwin was this.
Had enough of the ship of fools, my boy? You come to Papa right now. Turn me down this time, and you won't see me again for 1,000,000 years.
1,000,000 years, my God, 1,000,000 years. He wasn't fooling. As bad a father as he had been, he had always kept his promises, and he had never knowingly lied to me. So I took one step in his direction, but not a second one. I was like a female blue-footed booby at the start of a courtship dance. As in a courtship dance, that uncertain first step was the first tick of a clock,
which would become irresistible. Already I was changed, although I was still a long way from the nozzle. The throbbing of the Bayer de Darwin's engines became fainter, and the steel sun deck became transparent, so that I could see into the main saloon below where the Concabona girls were gnawing the bones of their innocent sister Kazakh. That first step toward my father made me think this about the Indian girls and Mary up in the crow's nest to my back, and Hisako Hiraguchi and her fetus in the lavatory, and the demoralized captain and the blind Selena on the bridge, and the corpse in the walk-in freezer. Why should I ever have cared about these strangers, these slaves of fear and hunger? What do they have to do with me? When I failed to take a second step in his direction, my father said, "Keep moving, Leon. No time to be coy." "But I haven't completed my research," I protested. I had chosen to be a ghost because the job carried with it, as a fringe benefit, license to read minds, to learn the truth of people's pasts, to see through walls, to be many places all at once, to learn in depth how this or that situation had come to be structured as it was, and to have access to all human knowledge. "Father," I said, "give me 5 more years.
5 years? He exclaimed.
He mocked me with the 3 previous bargains I had made with him.
"Just 1 more day, Dad. Just 1 more month, Daddy. Just 6 more months, Pop."
"But I'm learning so much about what life is really like, how it really works, what it's really all about," I said.
"Don't lie to me," he said. "Did I ever lie to you?"
"No, sir," I said.
"Then don't lie to me," he said.
"Are you a god now?" I said.
"No," he said. "I am still nothing but your father, Leon. But don't lie to me. For all your eavesdropping, you've accumulated nothing but information. You might as well be a collector of baseball cards or bottle caps. For the sense you can make of all the information you have now, you might as well be Mandarax."
"Just 5 more years, Daddy, Dad, Father, Pa," I said.
"Not nearly enough time for you to learn what you hope to learn," he said. "And that, my boy, is why I give you my word of honor. If you send me away now, I won't be back for 1 million years. "Leon! Leon! Leon!" he implored. "The more you learn about people, the more disgusted you'll become."
"I would have thought that you're being sent by the wisest men in your country, supposedly, to fight a nearly endless, thankless, horrifying, and finally pointless war, would have given you sufficient insight into the nature of humanity to last you throughout all eternity. Need I tell you that these same wonderful animals of which you apparently still want to learn more and more are at this very moment, proud as punch to have weapons in place, all set to go at a moment's notice, guaranteed to kill everything? Need I tell you that this once beautiful and nourishing planet, when viewed from the air, now resembles the diseased organs of poor Roy Hepburn when exposed at his autopsy? And that the apparent cancers, growing for the sake of growth alone, and consuming all and poisoning all, are the cities of your beloved human beings? Need I tell you that these animals have made such a botch of things that they can no longer imagine decent lives for their own grandchildren even, and will consider it a miracle if there is anything left to eat or enjoy by the year 2000? Now only 14 years away. Like the people on this accursed ship, my boy, they are led by captains who have no charts or compasses, and who deal from minute to minute with no problem more substantial than how to protect their self-esteem. As in life, he still needed a shave. As in life, he was still pale and haggard. As in life, he was still smoking a cigarette. And one reason, surely, that I had found it hard to take another step in his direction was that I did not like him. I had run away from home when I was 16 because I was so ashamed of him. If there had been an angel in the mouth of the Blue Tunnel instead of my father, I might have skipped right in. James Waite ran away from home because people were inflicting physical pain on him all the time. He might as well have gone straight from the delivery room to the Spanish Inquisition. So ingenious were some of the tortures the big brains of foster parents had devised for him. I ran away from a real parent who had never once in anger laid a hand on me. But when I was too young to know any better, my father had made me his co-conspirator in driving my mother away forever. He had me jeering along with him at mother for wanting to take a trip somewhere, to make some friends and have them over to dinner, to go to a movie or a restaurant sometime. I agreed with my father. I then believed that he was the greatest writer in the world, since that was all I could think to be proud of. We had no friends, and ours was the shabbiest house in the neighborhood, and we didn't even own a television set or an automobile, so why wouldn't I have defended him against my mother? To his credit anyway, he never suggested that he might have greatness. When I was green in judgment, though, I found greatness implied in his insistence on doing nothing but writing and smoking all the time. And I mean all the time. Oh, yes. And there was one other thing I could be proud of. And this really counted for something in Cohos. My father had been a United States Marine. When I got to be 16, though, I myself had arrived at the conclusion my mother and the neighbors had reached so long ago. That my father was a repellent failure. His work appearing only in the most disreputable publications, which paid him almost nothing. He was an insult to life itself, I thought, when he went on doing nothing with it but writing and smoking all the time, and I mean all the time. I was then flunking every course but art at school. Nobody flunked art at Cohos High School. That was simply impossible. And I ran away to find my mother, which I never did. Father had published more than 100 books and 1,000 short stories, but in all my travels I met only one person who had ever heard of him. Encountering such a person after so long a search was so confusing to me emotionally that I think I actually went crazy for a little while. I never telephoned Father or dropped him so much as a postcard. I did not know he had died until I myself had died, and he appeared to me for the first time at the mouth of the Blue Tunnel into the afterlife. Yet, I had honored him for the one thing I thought he had to be proud of still. I, too, had been a United States Marine. It was a family tradition. And by golly, if I haven't now become a writer, too. Scribbling away like Father, without the slightest hint that there might actually be a reader somewhere. There isn't one. There can't be one. So now we have both been like courting blue-footed boobies, doing what we had to do, whether there was anybody to notice, or far more likely not. Now Father said to me from the nozzle, "You're just like your mother." "In what way?" I said. "You know what her favorite quotation was," he said. I certainly did, and so did Mandrax. "It is the epigraph of this book." "You believe that human beings are good animals, who will eventually solve all their problems and make Earth into a Garden of Eden again." "Could I see her, please?" I said. I knew she was somewhere at the other end of the tunnel, that she was dead. That was the first thing I had asked Father after I myself was dead. "Do you know what became of Mother?" I had searched everywhere for her, before joining the United States Marines. Is that mother right behind you? I said. The blue tunnel was in a restless state of peristalsis. Its squirms often afforded me glimpses deep into its interior. I saw this woman in there, that third time Father appeared, and I thought it might be Mother. But no such luck.
It's Naomi Tharp, Leon,
the woman called out to me. She was the neighbor woman who, after my real mother left, did her best to be my mother for a little while.
It's Mrs. Tharp, she called. You remember me, don't you, Leon? You come in here just like you used to come in through my kitchen door. Be a good boy now. You don't want to be left out there for another million years.
I took another step toward the nozzle. The Bayer de Darwin became a fantasia of cobwebs. The blue tunnel became as substantial and sensible a means of transportation as the Malmö streetcar, which used to take me to and from the shipyard every day. But then, behind me, from up in the Bayer de Darwin's gossamer crow's nest, I heard the dim spook which Mary had become shouting something over and over again. She was in agony of some sort, I thought. I could not make out her words, but her tone would have been appropriate if she had been shot in the stomach. I had to know what she was saying, and so I took two steps backwards, and then turned and looked up at her. She was sobbing. She was laughing. She was bent over the rim of the steel bucket so that her head was upside down as she shouted to the captain on the bridge, "Land ho! Land ho! Praise God, dear God, land ho! Land ho!" Chapter 8. It was Santa Rosalia which Mary Hepburn saw. The captain would, of course, steer for it at once, hoping to find it inhabited by people, or at least populated by animals he and the others could cook and eat. What remained in question was whether I would be along to see what happened next. The price I would have to pay for satisfying my curiosity about the destinies of the people on the ship was unambiguous. To continue to haunt the earth, without a chance of parole, for a million years. The decision was made for me by Mary Hepburn, by Mrs. Fleming, whose joy in the crow's nest held my attention so long that when I looked back at the tunnel was gone. I have now completed that sentence of 1,000 millennia. I have paid in full my debt to society, or whatever. I can expect to see the blue tunnel again at any time. I will, of course, skip into its mouth most gladly. Nothing ever happens around here anymore that I haven't seen or heard so many times before. Nobody, surely, is going to write Beethoven's 9th Symphony, or tell a lie, or start a Third World War. Mother was right. Even in the darkest times, there really was still hope for humankind. On the afternoon of Monday, December 1st, 1986, Captain Adolf von Kleist, whose ship was without a util anchor, intentionally ran the Bayer de Darwin aground on a lava shoal which was close to shore. He believed that she could drag herself free, as she had done in Guayaquil, when it was time to sail again. When did he plan to sail again? As soon as the larders were stocked with eggs and boobies and iguanas and penguins and cormorants and crabs and anything else that was edible and easy to catch. When he had a food supply to match his stores of fuel and water, he could return at leisure to the mainland and seek a peaceful port which would take them in. He would rediscover the South American continent. He switched off his faithful engines. That would be the end of their faithfulness. For reasons he was never able to determine, they would never start again. This meant that the stoves and ovens and refrigerators would soon be out of business, too, as soon as the batteries ran down. There were still 10 meters of stern line,
of white nylon umbilical cord coiled by a cleat on the main deck. The captain tied knots in this, and then he and Mary climbed down it to the shoal and waded ashore to gather eggs and kill lower animals who had no fear of them. They would use Mary's blouse and James Waite's new shirt, which still had the price tag on it, for grocery bags. They wrung the necks of boobies. They caught land iguanas by their tails and beat them to death on black boulders. It was during this carnage that Mary would scratch herself, and a fearless vampire finch would take its first sip of human blood. The killers left the marine iguanas alone, believing them to be inedible. 2 years would pass before their discovery that partially digested seaweed in the bellies of these creatures was not only a tasty hot meal, ready-cooked, but a cure for vitamin and mineral deficiencies which had troubled them up to then. That would complete their diet. Some people, moreover, could digest this puree better than others, so that they were healthier and nicer-looking, more desirable as sexual partners. So the law of natural selection went to work, with the result, a million years later, that human beings can now digest seaweed for themselves without the intervention of marine iguanas, which they leave alone. That is such a much nicer arrangement for everyone. People still kill fish, though, and in times of fish shortages, they will still eat boobies, who still aren't afraid of them. I could stay here another million years, and that still wouldn't be time enough, I'm sure, for the boobies to realize that people are dangerous. Yes. And as I've already said, they still dance and dance at mating time. The people had quite a feast on the Bahia de Darwin that night. They ate on the sun deck, and the deck itself was the serving platter, and the captain was the chef. There were roasted land iguanas stuffed with crab meat and minced finches. There were roasted boobies stuffed with their own eggs and basted with melted penguin fat. It was perfectly delicious. Everybody was happy again. And at first light the next morning, the captain and Mary went ashore again and took the Concabona girls along. The girls could finally understand something which was going on. They all killed and killed, and hauled corpses and hauled corpses, until the ship's freezer contained, in addition to James Waite, enough birds and iguanas and eggs to last for a month if necessary. Now they not only had plenty of fuel and water, but no end of food, and good food too as well. Next, the captain would start the engines. He would head the ship due east at maximum velocity. There was no way he could miss South America, or Central America, or North America, the captain told Mary, his sense of humor returning, unless we are unlucky enough to pass through the Panama Canal. But if we do go through the canal, I can virtually guarantee you that we will be in Europe or Africa by and by. So he laughed and she laughed. Everything was going to be all right after all. But then, the engines wouldn't start. Chapter 9. By the time the Bahia de Darwin slid beneath the dead calm ocean, which was in September of 1996, everybody but the captain was calling her by a nickname given to her by Mary, which was the Walloping Window Blind. This disparaging title was taken from a song Mary learned from Mandarax, which went like this. A capital ship for an ocean trip was the Walloping Window Blind. No gale that blew dismayed her crew or troubled the captain's mind. The man at the wheel was taught to feel contempt for the wildest blow, and it often appeared, when the weather had cleared, that he'd been in his bunk below. Charles Carroll, 1842-1920. Hisako Hiraguchi and her furry daughter Akiko and Selena McIntosh all called her the Walloping Window Blind, and so did the Concabona women, who loved the sound of the words without understanding them. And when the Concabona women bore children, which they hadn't done yet, they would teach their young that they themselves had come from the mainland on a magic ship, since vanished, called the Walloping Window Blind. Akiko, who was fluent in Kankabono as well as English and Japanese, and who was the only non-Kankabono who could converse with the Kankabonos, would never find a satisfactory way to translate this into Kankabono, the Walloping Window Blind. The Kankabonos could no more understand it and its comical intent than could a modern person, if I were to whisper in his or her ear as he or she basked on a white sandy beach by a blue lagoon, the Walloping Window Blind. It was soon after the Walloping Window Blind went to the bottom that Mary began her artificial insemination program. She was then 61. She was the sole sexual partner of the captain, who was 66, and whose sexual drive was no longer all that compelling. And he was determined not to reproduce, since he felt that there was still a good chance that he could pass on Huntington's chorea. Also, he was a racist, and so not at all drawn to Hisako or her furry daughter, and least of all to the Indian women, who would ultimately bear his children. Remember, these people were expecting to be rescued at any time, and had no way of knowing that they were the last hope for the human race. So that they engaged in sexual activities simply to pass some of the time pleasantly, to relieve an itch, or to make themselves sleepy, or what you will. So far as anybody knew, reproducing would actually be irresponsible, since Santa Rosalia was no place to raise children, and children would also place strains on the food supply. Mary felt this as strongly as anyone before the Walloping Window Blind joined the Ecuadorian fleet of submarines, that it would be a tragedy if a child were born. Her soul continued to feel that. But her big brain began to wonder, idly, so as not to spook her, if the sperm, which the captain squirted into her about twice a month, could be transferred to a fertile woman somehow. With, hey, presto, a resulting pregnancy. Akiko, who was only 10 then, wasn't yet ovulating, but the Kankabono women, who ranged in age from 15 to 19, surely were. Mary's big brain told her what she had so often told her students, that there was no harm and possibly a lot of good in people's playing with all sorts of ideas in their heads, no matter how supposedly impossible or impractical or downright crazy they seemed to be. She reassured herself there on Santa Rosalia, as she had reassured the adolescents of Ilium, that mental games played with even the trashiest ideas had led to many of the most significant scientific insights of what she, a million years ago, called modern times. She consulted Mandarax about curiosity. Quoth Mandarax, "Curiosity is one of the permanent and certain characteristics of a vigorous mind." Samuel Johnson, 1709 to 1784. What Mandarax didn't tell her, and what her big brain certainly wasn't going to tell her, was that if she came up with an idea for a novel experiment which had a chance of working, her big brain would make her life a hell until she had actually performed that experiment. That, in my opinion, was the most diabolical aspect of those old-time big brains. They would tell their owners, in effect, "Here is a crazy thing we could actually do, probably, but we would never do it, of course. It's just fun to think about." And then, as though in trances, the people would really do it. Have slaves fight each other to the death in the Colosseum, or burn people alive in the public square for holding opinions which were locally unpopular, or build factories whose only purpose was to kill people in industrial quantities, or to blow up whole cities, and on and on. Somewhere in Mandarax there should have been, but was not, a warning to this effect. In this era of big brains, anything which can be done will be done. So hunker down.
The closest Mandarax came to saying anything like that was a quotation from Thomas Carlyle, 1795 to 1881. Doubt, of whatever kind, can be ended in action alone. Mary's doubts about whether a woman could be impregnated by another one on a desert island without any technical assistance led to her taking action. In a trance-like state, she found herself visiting the camp of the Kankabona women on the other side of the crater, having brought Akiko along as an interpreter. And now I catch myself remembering my father when he was still alive, when he was still an ink-stained wretch in Kohos. He was always hoping to sell something to the movies, so that he wouldn't have to take odd jobs, and we could get a cook and cleaning lady. But no matter how much he might yearn for a movie sale, the crucial scenes in every one of his stories and books were events which nobody in his right mind would ever want to put into a movie. Not if he wanted the movie to be popular. So now I myself am telling a story whose crucial scene could never have been included in a popular movie of a million years ago. In it, Mary Hepburn, as though hypnotized, dips her right index finger into herself and then into an 18-year-old Kankabona woman, making her pregnant. Mary would later think of a joke she might make about the rash, inexplicable, irresponsible, plain, crazy liberties she had taken with the bodies of not just one, but all of the Kankabona teenagers.